Imagine you're sitting at a bar on a Friday night. You just wrapped up this massive, grueling project at work, and you're finally catching up with a close friend you haven't seen in a while.
Right, you're finally getting to decompress.
Exactly. So naturally, you tell them a tiny, exciting detail about your company's upcoming partnership. You don't tell them to buy stock, and you definitely don't make a dime off the conversation. But what if I told you that that single casual conversation is all it takes to make you a federal suspect?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like this really aggressive hypothetical, but it's actually one of the most frequent ways that well-meaning professionals accidentally implode their careers.
It's wild. And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive today. We are exploring this fascinating and frankly, kind of terrifying compliance training document from Excellus.
Yeah, the training is called Is It Insider Trading If I Didn't Trade?
Right. And our goal here is to unpack the hidden legal landmines buried in our everyday social interactions. So to do that, we're going to look at a very specific, highly relatable scenario from the source material. It involves two friends, an algorithm, and the deeply counterintuitive realities of corporate law.
And well, what's fascinating here is that most people fundamentally misunderstand what insider trading actually looks like in the modern era. Like they really do.
Oh, absolutely.
When we hear the term, we're conditioned by movies to picture something deliberately nefarious.
Yeah.
A dark room, a burner phone, a briefcase full of cash, maybe a secret offshore brokerage account.
Like a movie villain.
Exactly.
Right.
People assume it requires malicious intent. But the material we are diving into proves that the most dangerous risk for the average employee isn't corporate espionage. It's really just casual, everyday human connection.
Right, because to truly understand how this area of the law works, we really have to start by understanding human behavior. So let's jump straight into this Excellus scenario.
Yeah, let's do it.
So the scenario centers on these two friends, Maya and Daniel. Let's look at Maya first. She's a senior engineer at a tech company, and for 4 months straight, she has been working grueling hours on this massive partnership integration.
I mean, 4 months of just nonstop work,
Yeah.
which means she is completely invested both professionally and emotionally. It has consumed her life.
Oh, yeah, she's practically living and breathing this integration. So Friday afternoon rolls around, and company leadership finally confirms internally that the official announcement is going out in exactly 2 weeks.
She must be so relieved.
Totally thrilled. So that same night, she meets up for drinks with her former colleague and close friend, Daniel, and the conversation naturally turns to work. Driven by just pure excitement and relief, she mentions the upcoming partnership.
Which, is such a natural thing to do.
Right. She doesn't give him a stock tip. She
Yeah.
doesn't slide a confidential dossier across the table. She just says, and I'm quoting the scenario here, "We're about to announce something huge. It involves this partner company. It's going to change everything for us."
And psychologically, that is a completely normal thing to say. She is treating this information like a personal milestone.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. Maya treats this information like she's sharing a minor spoiler for a movie she just spent a year helping to direct. She's just proud of her work. She doesn't trade a single share.
Right.
She doesn't tell Daniel to go buy anything. She just shares her good news, they toast to it, and they change the subject. But over the weekend, Daniel starts thinking about that passing comment.
Of course he does.
Now, Daniel is not a securities professional. He's just a guy with a standard retail brokerage account that he barely uses. But he knows the partner company Maya mentioned happens to be publicly traded.
And this is exactly where the internal rationalization happens. Daniel tells himself he's just making a sensible financial decision. He doesn't view himself as a corporate insider or, a criminal.
Right. He views himself as a smart guy who heard some interesting industry news and is just connecting the dots on his own.
He probably thinks, well, I would have researched this tech company eventually anyway. This just bumped it up my to-do list.
Exactly. So Monday morning rolls around. Daniel logs into his account and buys 400 shares of the partner company. 2 weeks later, the partnership is officially announced to the public. The stock pops 18%. Daniel sells his shares, makes a tidy profit, and likely thinks he's an absolute genius.
But he isn't a genius. He is a tipping point. The training actually breaks down exactly why this happens by looking at the specific psychological pressures Maya was under at that bar.
Right, because Maya wasn't acting like a criminal mastermind.
Not at all. She fell victim to three overlapping behavioral pressures. The training identifies them as relationship, normalization, and ambiguity.
Wait, let's actually pause and dig into those because I think anyone listening can relate to all three.
Yeah, so the first is relationship pressure. She's talking to a trusted former colleague. When we're with people we trust, our professional guard naturally drops.
That makes total sense. And normalization.
Normalization is just, I mean, we all talk about work with our friends. It is completely standard social behavior to debrief your week, complain about your boss, or, you know, celebrate a win.
I have to admit that normalization pressure hits hard. If you're listening to this right now, think about how you decompress. If I spend 60 or 70 hours a week staring at a specific problem, and then I go to dinner with a close friend, I'm going to talk about it.
Oh, absolutely.
It's practically impossible to completely compartmentalize that. You want the people you care about to know what you're dedicating your life to. And frankly, if you're listening to this and thinking, well, I only talk to my spouse about work, so I'm safe, the reality is that's just as dangerous, right?
Statistically, spouses and immediate family members are among the absolute highest risk tipping channels for that exact reason.
Yeah.
The normalization pressure is at its absolute peak at the dinner table.
Wow. Okay. And that leads to the third pressure, ambiguity.
Right. Because Maya didn't explicitly say, hey, go buy this stock. It didn't feel illegal to her.
So because she didn't make a financial recommendation, her brain just didn't categorize the conversation as a legal event.
Precisely. It was just catching up.
Mm.
But the combination of those three things, relationship, normalization, and ambiguity, is what makes this specific scenario the highest frequency insider trading violation in the corporate world.
Okay, so Daniel makes his trade on a Monday morning. It seems totally isolated. He's just one guy sitting at a computer. How on earth does that casual Friday night chat become federal evidence? I mean, how do they actually get caught?
Well, it comes down to the terrifying efficiency of modern market surveillance algorithms. We are no longer living in an era where regulators like the SEC rely entirely on whistleblowers or paper trails to catch unusual activity.
Wait, really? The regulatory bodies have algorithms for this?
Oh, yeah. They have systems specifically designed to identify the exact kind of anomaly Daniel just created in the market.
But how does that actually work mechanically? Because algorithms can sometimes feel like a magic word we throw around to explain things we don't understand.
Fair point. Think about it this way. Before any major material announcement like a merger, an acquisition, or a massive partnership, regulators are already monitoring the stock of the companies involved.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right. So when the announcement goes public and the stock pops 18%, the algorithm instantly looks backward. It scans the preceding days and weeks for anomalies.
So it's basically searching in reverse.
Exactly. And it spots Daniel's account. It sees a small retail account with no prior history of trading this specific stock, suddenly buying a meaningful stake exactly 2 weeks before the announcement.
Oh, wow. So it's perfectly timed, highly specific, and completely uncharacteristic for his portfolio.
Yep. It's like dropping a dye packet into a river. The SEC doesn't need to know Maya personally. They just watch where the blue dye of this specific corporate knowledge flows.
Yeah.
And they wait to see whose bank account turns blue.
That is a terrifyingly perfect analogy. The algorithm is entirely emotionless. It just looks for statistically impossible timing.
Exactly. And once it flags Daniel's trade, the investigation phase begins, which is where things get truly invasive.
Because here's detail from the text that should make anyone pause. Once the trade is flagged, the regulators reconstruct the social graph between Daniel and the insiders at the company.
Oh, yeah. They're actively hunting for the connection between the suspiciously timed trade and the source of the leak.
Right. They stitch together digital lives. Regulators can subpoena brokerage records, then cross-reference those with employment databases. They look at LinkedIn connections, university alumni networks, shared addresses, and even digital payment histories like Venmo or Zelle.
The algorithm doesn't necessarily know they had drinks on a specific Friday night, but it knows Daniel bought the stock on Monday, and it definitively knows he's socially connected to Maya, who had access to the partnership data.
Wait, I have to jump in here and push back on behalf of anyone listening, because something about this feels profoundly unfair. Daniel's the one who logged into a brokerage. He took the action. Maya made $0 from this. She didn't open an account. She didn't get a kickback. She didn't get a cut of his profits. How is her casual bragging considered a federal crime?
That reaction is completely normal, but it reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of the law. And this brings us to the real aha moment of the Excellus training. We have to clarify what the legal definition of tipping actually is.
Please, because if the trade is just the consequence, that implies the actual crime is just opening your mouth. Is tipping literally just the act of talking?
In many ways, yes. The critical thing to understand is that the unauthorized disclosure itself is the violation. Daniel's tree is just the consequence of her disclosure, and ultimately becomes the glaring mathematical evidence that her disclosure happened.
Wow.
Yeah. But the crime, for Maya, was simply sharing material non-public information, what compliance professionals refer to as MNPI, with someone outside the authorized circle.
Let's actually break down material for a second. Because non-public is obvious, it's not on the news yet, but material feels so subjective. How do you define that?
It's actually a very specific threshold in securities law. Information is considered material if a reasonable investor would consider it important in deciding whether to buy, sell, or hold a stock.
So if it has the realistic potential to move the stock price, it's material.
Exactly. A change to the company cafeteria menu. Not material.
Sure.
A massive, unannounced partnership with a publicly traded giant. Absolutely material.
So the defense of, you know, but I didn't tell him to buy anything, means absolutely nothing to an investigator.
It is entirely useless as a defense. Under the law, your intention does not negate the fact of the disclosure. The moment Maya named the partner company and the timeline at that bar, she crossed the legal line.
So Maya is now legally exposed because she shared material information, despite not making a single dime. But surely the exact legal mechanism punishing her depends on where she is, right? If I'm listening to this in Austin, Texas versus London or Berlin, do I have the exact same liability?
You have liability in both, but the mechanics of why you are liable are fascinatingly different. Let's look at United States securities law first.
Okay.
Under SEC Rule 10b-5, tipping liability historically requires two things to be proven: a breach of fiduciary duty and a personal benefit to the tipper.
Okay, a breach of duty makes sense. You owe your company loyalty to keep their secrets. But that personal benefit part is where the confusion lies, right? Because we just established Maya didn't get a financial benefit.
Exactly. People logically assume benefit means cash or a tangible kickback. But the legal loophole that trips up so many employees in the U.S. is that the courts have defined personal benefit to include the non-monetary, emotional benefit of gifting information to a close friend or relative.
That is wild. So just the warm, fuzzy feeling of giving your friend a juicy piece of news or boosting your own ego by showing off how important your project is counts as a personal benefit under U.S. federal law.
Yes. The U.S. courts have basically determined that giving a gift of confidential information to a friend is legally no different than trading on it yourself and handing them the cash profits as a present.
But here's where it gets really interesting for anyone working globally. The source material contrasts that U.S. rule with the European standard, specifically the European Market Abuse Regulation, or EUMR Article 10.
Oh, yeah. The European regulators do not care about your warm, fuzzy feelings at all.
Not even slightly. EUMR is a significantly stricter standard. It removes the personal benefit requirement entirely.
Right. There is no complex legal analysis of whether you had a fiduciary duty or whether you were gifting information to boost your ego.
Under EUMR, it is simply unlawful to disclose inside information to any person outside the normal required exercise of your employment or profession. Full stop. It is a zero ambiguity standard.
If it is not strictly required for your specific job function to tell that specific person at that specific moment, it is an unlawful disclosure.
And we need to explain why these two systems are so different, because it really helps you understand the mindset of the regulators investigating you. The U.S. law is fundamentally rooted in anti-fraud concepts. They want to punish people for stealing corporate secrets for their own gain.
Exactly. But the European law is rooted in a philosophy of market parity. The European perspective is that a financial market is only fair and functional if absolutely everyone has access to the exact same information at the exact same time.
So any asymmetry is a threat to the market's integrity, regardless of whether someone personally benefited from sharing the secret.
Yes. Which means if you are listening to this right now in a U.S. office, maybe in Chicago or Seattle, you cannot just assume you only have to worry about the SEC's personal benefit rule.
Right, because if your company has European employees, or if your company's stock is dual listed on a European exchange, you might suddenly find yourself held to that stricter zero ambiguity EU standard.
It's a critical reality check. The compliance landscape is entirely global now. You cannot rely on an I didn't benefit defense if EUMOR applies to your organization. In Maya's case, both legal frameworks reach the exact same devastating conclusion: she committed a tipping violation.
Okay, so now that we understand the very real, very terrifying legal reality of how this works, let's shift to when you are most vulnerable to making this exact mistake. because there are certain times in a company's life cycle where this risk absolutely skyrockets.
The material identifies a very specific high-risk danger zone. It's when private companies transition to the public markets, the period leading up to an IPO.
The quiet period.
Yes. And you have to think about the culture of a private startup to understand why this is so dangerous. For years, maybe a decade, employees have been freely sharing company news.
Right. They gossip about partnerships. They talk openly with trusted friends about revenue with absolutely zero securities law consequences because the company isn't public.
It's just how startups operate. Everyone is excited. Everyone is hustling. And you tell your friends what you're building over beers. It's how you recruit people.
Exactly. But then the company files its S-1.
Right. Just to clarify for anyone who hasn't been through an IPO, the S-1 is that massive public registration document a company files with the SEC to formally announce their intention to go public.
It's the official starting gun. And the moment that S-1 is filed, the company enters the legally mandated quiet period. But human behavioral habits don't just magically disappear overnight.
No, they don't. You can't just train people out of a years-long habit of open communication with a single 20-minute online module.
Think about the painful irony here. The IPO period actually generates the most exciting news in a company's entire history, right at the exact moment the federal government says you have to stop talking about it.
It's true. Just when you have the most thrilling things to say, you are legally gagged. It is a perfect psychological storm for compliance failures. The pressure to share is at its peak, and the legal tolerance is at absolute zero.
So how do we actually navigate this gray area? The XLS training breaks down a sliding scale of choices for both Maya and Daniel. I want you listening to imagine what you would do in these scenarios, knowing what you know now about the algorithms. Let's start with Maya at the bar on Friday night.
Okay, so she essentially has three options. Choice A is what she actually did in the scenario she shared the news.
Right. She kept it casual. She made no financial recommendation, but she disclosed the specific partner company and the timeline.
And as we've exhaustively established, choice A is a federal violation. Tipping. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Okay, so what's choice B?
Choice B is what the training calls the floor of acceptable professional behavior. She keeps the conversation entirely generic. She says something like, "Yeah, work is really intense right now, but it's exciting. I'll tell you all about it once our big announcement is out in a few weeks."
So she gives nothing material away. No partner company name, no specific timeline, no actionable data. It's safe. But then there's choice C, which is the most interesting path.
Right. Choice C is the proactive defensive approach. Let's say she's exhausted, her guard is down, and she accidentally starts to mention the project but catches herself mid-sentence.
Okay, she realizes the partner is publicly traded.
Exactly. In choice C, she stops and tells Daniel directly, "Actually, I really shouldn't be sharing this. There are strict securities law implications, and I need to keep the details to myself."
And then this is the crucial part. She reports that near-miss conversation to her internal compliance team.
Yes. Now let's look at Daniel's choices on Monday morning. When he's staring at his brokerage account. Choice A, he buys the shares. He thinks he's acting independently based on his own brilliant dots he connected.
And that's a violation for him. It's called tippy liability.
Right. Even though he is not a corporate insider, the law says a reasonable person in his position should recognize that an unannounced partnership involving his friend's company is heavily guarded inside information. By trading on it, he is participating in the abuse of that information.
Okay, choice B, he recognizes the legal risk and simply doesn't make the trade. He closes the laptop and walks away.
That's the correct legal call to keep himself out of federal court. But choice C is what he should do if he actually wants to be a good friend to Maya.
Right. Choice C for Daniel is picking up the phone, calling Maya and saying, "Hey, what you told me at the bar sounds highly confidential. I am absolutely not going to trade on it, but you need to flag our conversation to your legal team right now to protect yourself, just in case."
And that highlights the absolute most important takeaway from this entire XLS training module, cultivating what they call a compliance reflex.
The compliance reflex. Break that down for us. What is that in practice?
It is the ingrained instinct to choose choice C, the absolute best course of action for both the person who leaked the info and the person who heard it, is early transparent disclosure to the internal compliance or legal team before any trading happens.
Right, because if material information slips out in a casual conversation, you cannot put the toothpaste back in the tube.
You really can't. And you can't just cross your fingers and hope the algorithm doesn't notice the social graph. Waiting to see if the SEC flags a downstream trade is a doomed strategy.
So if you report your own accidental disclosure immediately, it demonstrates good faith.
Exactly. It gives your legal team the information they need to assess the risk and monitor the situation. Most importantly, it creates a documented paper trail of compliance, rather than forcing the SEC to uncover a paper trail of a cover-up.
So what does this all mean for you listening? We started this deep dive talking about venting at a bar on a Friday night, and we've ended up dissecting the philosophy behind global market abuse regulations.
It's pretty wild escalation.
It really is. But the core takeaway here is that your casual social interactions carry immense unseen professional weight. Being what the training calls a decision-ready employee means recognizing that the rules of harmless gossip completely change the second your company's data becomes material to the market.
Yeah, it means understanding that the line between being a supportive friend and being a federal co-conspirator is terrifyingly thin.
It really is. And if we zoom out and connect this to the bigger picture, it raises a deeply important question, one that goes far beyond just corporate compliance training and touches on how we actually live our lives in a hyper-connected, deeply surveilled world.
I love a good existential question. Let's hear it.
Well, we spent a lot of time discussing how market surveillance algorithms trace the social graph to connect Daniel's seemingly isolated trade back to Maya's knowledge. Regulators can map our relationships through our digital exhaust.
Right, they map everything.
So if algorithms can now seamlessly map our private, real-world friendships to global financial movements, is there really any such thing as an off-the-record conversation anymore?
Oh, wow.
Right. When our personal social networks, the people we drink with, the people we complain to, and the people we celebrate our biggest wins with are simultaneously our greatest emotional support systems and our biggest potential legal liabilities, how does that fundamentally change who we choose to trust with our good news?
That is a heavy, fascinating thought to chew on the next time you sit down for a well-deserved Friday night drink. Just remember, keep your good news close to the chest. We will catch you on the next deep dive.